Herbert Richardson was a Vietnam War veteran whose nightmarish experiences in brutal conditions left him traumatized and scarred. He enlisted in the Army in 1964 at the age of 18, at a time when America was heavily involved in combat. He was assigned to the 11th Aviation Group, 1st Cavalry Division, and was sent to Camp Radcliffe in An Ky, Vietnam. The camp was near Pleiku, an area known for extremely heavy fighting in the mid-1960s. Herbert endured perilous missions in which he saw friends get killed or seriously injured. On one mission, his entire platoon was killed in an ambush, and he was severely injured. He regained consciousness coated in the blood of his fellow soldiers. He was disoriented and unable to move. It didn't take long before he experienced a complete mental breakdown. He attempted suicide after suffering severe headaches. Despite multiple referrals from commanding officers for psychiatric evaluation, he remained in combat for 7 months before his crying outbursts and uncommunicative withdrawal resulted in an honorable discharge in December 1966. Not surprisingly, his trauma followed him home to Brooklyn, New York, where he had nightmares, suffered disabling headaches, and sometimes ran out of his house screaming, "Incoming!" He married and had children, but his post-traumatic stress disorder continued to undermine his ability to manage his behavior. He ended up in a veterans hospital in New York City, where he had a slow, difficult recovery from severe head pain associated with his war injuries. Herbert became one of thousands of combat veterans who end up in jail or prison after completing their military service. One of the country's least discussed post-war problems is how frequently combat veterans bring the traumas of war back with them and are incarcerated after returning to their communities. By the mid-1980s, nearly 20% of the people in jails and prisons in the United States had served in the military. While the rate declined in the 1990s, as the shadows cast by the Vietnam War began to recede, it has picked up again as a result of the military conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Herbert's care at the Veterans Hospital in New York City slowly allowed him to recover. He eventually met a nurse there, a woman from Dothan, Alabama, whose compassionate care made him feel comfortable and hopeful for the first time, perhaps in his entire life. When she was around, he felt alive and believed things would be all right. She had saved his life. When she moved back home to Alabama, Herbert followed. He tried to date her and even told her he wanted to marry her. At first, she resisted because she knew that Herbert was still suffering the effects of his time in combat, but ultimately, she gave in. They had a brief, intimate relationship, and Herbert had never been happier. He became intensely protective of his girlfriend, but she began to see his desperate and relentless focus on her as something closer to obsessive need than love. She tried to end the relationship. After months of unsuccessfully trying to create distance from Herbert, she finally insisted that he stay away. Instead, Herbert moved even closer to her home in Dothan, which elevated her anxieties. It got to the point where she refused to allow him to see her, talk to her, or get anywhere near her. Herbert was convinced that she was just confused and would eventually come back to him. He was deluded by obsession. His logic and reasoning became corrupted, irrational, and increasingly dangerous. Herbert was not unintelligent. In fact, he was quite smart, with a particular aptitude for electronics and mechanics, and he had a big heart. But he was still recovering from the trauma of the war, as well as some serious traumas that preceded his military experience. His mother had died when he was just 3 years old, and he had struggled with drugs and alcohol before he decided to enlist. The horrors of war had added a new level of distress to an already damaged psyche. He came up with an idea to win back his girlfriend. He decided that if she felt threatened, she would come to him for protection. He concocted a tragically misguided plan. He would construct a small bomb and place it on her front porch. He would detonate the bomb and then run to her aid to save her, and then they would live happily ever after. It was the kind of reckless use of explosives that wouldn't have been sensible in a combat zone, much less in a poor black neighborhood in Dothan, Alabama. One morning, Herbert completed his assembly of the bomb and placed it on his former girlfriend's porch. The woman's niece and another little girl came out instead and saw the peculiar package. The 10-year-old niece was drawn to the odd bag with the clock on it and picked up the device. She shook the clock to see if it would tick, which triggered a violent explosion. The child was killed instantly, and her 12-year-old friend, who was standing next to her, was traumatized. Herbert knew both children. In this community, children were always roaming the streets looking for something to do. Herbert loved kids and would invite them into his yard, pay them to do errands, and talk to them. He started making cereal and cooking for the kids who would wander by. The two girls had come by his house for breakfast. Herbert, watching the house from across the street, was devastated. He had planned to run to his girlfriend's aid when the bomb exploded, to reinforce his readiness to protect her and to keep her safe. When the child picked up the bomb and it detonated, Herbert ran across the street and found himself in a circle of grieving neighbors. It didn't take long for police to make an arrest. They found pipes and other bomb-making materials in Herbert's car and front yard. Because the victims were black and poor, this wasn't the kind of case that would usually be prosecuted as a capital crime, but Herbert wasn't local. His identity as an outsider, a northerner, and the nature of the crime seemed to generate heightened contempt from law enforcement officials. Placing a bomb anywhere in Dothan, even in a poor section of town, posed a different kind of threat than typical domestic violence. The prosecutor argued that Herbert was not just tragically misguided and reckless, he was evil. The state sought the death penalty. After striking all of the black prospective jurors in a county that is 28% black, the prosecutor told the all-white jury in his closing argument that a conviction was appropriate because Herbert was associated with black Muslims from New York City and deserved no mercy. Alabama's capital statute requires that any murder eligible for the death penalty be intentional, but it was clear that Herbert had no intent to kill the child. The state decided to invoke an unprecedented theory of transferred intent to make the crime eligible for the death penalty. But Herbert had no intention to kill anyone. Herbert was advised to deny any culpability, but ultimately argued that this was reckless murder, not capital murder, which could be punished with life imprisonment, but not the death penalty. During the trial, the appointed defense lawyer presented no evidence about Herbert's background, his military service, his trauma from the war, his relationship with the victim, his obsession with the girlfriend, nothing. Alabama's statute at the time limited what court-appointed lawyers could be paid for their out-of-court preparation time to $1,000, so the lawyer spent almost no time on the case. The trial lasted just over a day, and the judge quickly condemned Herbert to death. Following the imposition of the death sentence, Herbert's appointed lawyer, who was later disbarred for poor performance in other cases, told Herbert that he didn't see any reason to appeal the conviction or sentence because the trial had been as fair as he could expect. Herbert reminded him that he'd been sentenced to death. He wanted to appeal no matter how unlikely the prospects, but his lawyer filed no brief. Herbert was confined on death row for 11 years until it was his time to face Yellow Mama. A volunteer lawyer had challenged the intent questions in a desperate appeal but was unsuccessful. Herbert's execution was now set for August 18, just 3 weeks away. After my call with Herbert, I filed a flurry of stay motions in various courts. I knew the odds were low that we would block the execution. By the late 1980s, the U.S. Supreme Court had grown impatient with challenges to capital punishment. The court had justified reauthorization of the death penalty in the mid-1970s on the promise that proceedings would be subject to heightened scrutiny and meticulous compliance with the law, but then began to retreat from the existing review procedures. The court's rulings had become increasingly hostile to death row prisoners and less committed to the notion that death is different, requiring more careful review. The court decided to bar claims from federal habeas corpus review if they weren't initially presented to state courts. Federal courts were then forbidden to consider new evidence unless it was first presented to state courts. The court began insisting that federal judges defer more to state court rulings, which tended to be more indulgent of errors and defects in capital proceedings. In the 1980s, the court rejected a constitutional challenge to imposing the death penalty on juveniles, upheld the death penalty for disabled people suffering from mental retardation, and in a widely condemned opinion, found no constitutional violation in the extreme racial disparities that could be seen throughout most death penalty jurisdictions. By the end of the decade, some justices had become openly critical of the review that death penalty cases received. Chief Justice William Rehnquist urged restrictions on death penalty appeals and the endless efforts of lawyers to stop executions. "Let's get on with it," he famously declared at a Bar Association event in 1988. Finality, not fairness, had become the new priority in death penalty jurisprudence. 2 weeks after my first conversation with Herbert Richardson, I was frantically trying to get a stay of execution. Even though it was very late in the process, I was hoping that we might win a stay when I saw some of the compelling issues in Herbert's case. While his guilt wasn't really in question, there were persuasive reasons why this case should not have been a capital murder case, above and beyond the absence of a specific intent to kill. And even if you disregard that part of it, there was strong evidence that the death penalty should not be imposed because of Herbert's trauma, military service, and childhood difficulties. None of this compelling mitigating evidence was presented at trial, and it should have been. The death penalty can be imposed fairly only after carefully considering all the reasons why death might not be the appropriate sentence, and that didn't happen in Herbert's case. I was increasingly becoming convinced that Herbert was facing execution because he had been an easy target. He was unaided and easily condemned by a system that was inattentive to the precise legal requirements of capital punishment. I was deeply distressed that, had he gotten the right help at the right time, Herbert would not be on death row, with an execution date in less than 2 weeks. I asked several courts to stay Herbert's execution because of his ineffective lawyer, racial bias during the trial, the inflammatory comments made by the prosecutor, and the lack of mitigation evidence presented. Each court said, "Too late." We got a hastily scheduled hearing in the trial court in Dothan, where I tried to present evidence that the bomb Herbert had constructed was designed to go off at a certain time. I found an expert to testify that the bomb was a timed device and not intended to kill on contact. I knew that the court would probably conclude that this evidence should have been presented at trial or in prior proceedings, but I hoped that the judge could be persuaded. Herbert was in court with me, and we both immediately recognized the lack of interest on the judge's face. This heightened Herbert's anxiety. He began a whispered dialogue with me, imploring me to get the testifying expert to say things about his intent that were really outside the expert's knowledge. He became contentious and started making comments that were audible to the judge. Meanwhile, the judge kept stressing that the evidence wasn't newly discovered and should have been presented at trial, so it couldn't create a basis for a stay of execution. I asked for a brief recess to try and calm Herbert down. "He's not saying what I need him to say." His breathing was panicked. He held his head and told me he had a severe headache. "I didn't intend to kill anybody, and he has to explain that," he cried. I tried to comfort him. "Mr. Richardson, we've covered this. The expert isn't allowed to speak to your mental state. He's testified that the bomb was designed to be detonated, but he can't really explain your motivations. The court won't permit that, and he really can't speak to that." "They're not even paying attention to what he's saying," he said, sadly rubbing his temples. "I know, but remember, this is just the first step. We didn't expect much from this judge, but this will help us on appeal. I know this is frustrating for you." He looked at me worriedly before sighing in resignation. He sat glumly through the rest of the hearing, holding his head, which I found even more disheartening than when he was argumentative and distraught. Because I hadn't hired any lawyers yet, I didn't have co-counsel to sit with me and help manage documents or help with the defendant during the hearing. At the end of the proceeding, Herbert was shackled and sent back to death row, vexed, disappointed, and unhappy. I wasn't feeling much better as I packed up my things and headed out of the courtroom. It would have been nice to debrief with someone, to evaluate whether what was presented might provide a basis for a stay. I had no expectation that the local judge would grant a stay, but I was hopeful that maybe a reviewing court would recognize that this wasn't an intentional killing and that a stay should be granted. So much was going on that I couldn't objectively evaluate if we had presented enough evidence to change the picture of the case. I mostly felt bad that I'd left Herbert in such a distraught state. On my way out, I saw a group of black women and children huddled together in the back of the courtroom. 7 or 8 of them were watching me intensely. The hearing had been set in the late afternoon when there were no other proceedings scheduled. I was curious about who these people might be, but honestly, I was too tired to really care. I smiled and nodded a weary greeting to the 3 women who seemed most focused on me, which they took as a cue to approach me as I was about to walk out the door. The woman who spoke seemed nervous and somewhat fearful. She spoke hesitantly. "I'm Rena May's mother, the victim's mother. They said they would help us, but they never did. Mary Lynn can't hear right. Her hearing ain't never been right since that bomb. And her sister has nerve problems. I got 'em too. We were hoping you would help us." The stunned look on my face prompted her to say more. "I know you're busy. It's just that we could use the help." I realized that she'd cautiously offered her hand to me as she spoke, and I held it in mine. "I'm so very sorry you haven't received the help you've been promised, but I actually represent Herbert Richardson in this case," I said as gently as I could. "We know that. I know you might not be able to do anything right now, but when this is over, can you help us? They said we'd get some money for medical help and help for my daughter's hearing." A young woman had quietly approached the woman as she spoke to me and embraced her. While she was probably in her early 20s, she acted in every other respect like a very small child. She leaned her head into her mother's side like a much younger child would and looked at me sadly. Another woman approached and spoke somewhat defiantly. "I'm her auntie," she said. "We don't believe in killing people." I wasn't exactly sure what she was trying to say, but I looked at her and replied, "Yes, I don't believe in killing people either." The aunt seemed to relax a little. "All this grieving is hard. We can't cheer for that man you're trying to help, but don't want to have to grieve for him too. There shouldn't be no more killing behind this. I don't know what I can do to help you all, but I do want to help. Please contact me after August 18, and I'll see what I can find out." The aunt then asked me if she could have her son write to me because he was in prison and needed a lawyer. She sighed with relief when I gave her my card. As we all left the courthouse, we offered each other solemn goodbyes. "We'll pray for you," the aunt said as they departed. On the way to my car, I considered asking them to say something to the prosecutor and state lawyers about not wanting Mr. Richardson to be executed, although it was clear that the state wasn't acting on behalf of these victims. The courtroom had been filled with state lawyers and other officials watching the hearing, but they had long since fled the courthouse without so much as a word to any of the battered souls standing in the back of the room. I was haunted by the tragic irony that they felt I was their best hope for help. The trial judge had denied our request for a stay of execution by the time I got back to Montgomery. He ruled our evidence was untimely, meaning that he could not consider it. With less than a week before the execution, the next few days involved one frantic filing after the next. Finally, on the day before the execution, I filed a petition for review and a motion for a stay of execution in the U.S. Supreme Court. Even in death penalty cases, the court grants review only in a small percentage of the cases filed. A petition for certiorari, a request to review a lower court's ruling, is very rarely granted. But I'd known all along that the Supreme Court was our best chance for a stay of execution. Even when lower courts granted a stay, the state would appeal, so the Supreme Court would almost always make the final decision to permit an execution to proceed or not. The execution was scheduled for 12:01 a.m. on August 18. I had finally finished the petition and faxed it to the court late on the night of August 16, and had spent the next morning in my Montgomery office, waiting anxiously for the court's decision. I tried to busy myself by reading files in other cases, including Walter McMillan's. I didn't expect we'd hear from the court until the afternoon, but that didn't keep me from staring at the phone all morning. Whenever the phone rang, my pulse quickened. Eva and Doris, our receptionist, knew that I was anxiously awaiting the call. We had submitted an extensive clemency petition to the governor with affidavits from family members and color photographs, but I didn't expect anything in response. The petition detailed Herbert's military service and explained why military veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder are worthy of compassion. I wasn't very hopeful. Michael Lindsay had received a life verdict from the jury and was executed instead. Horace Duncans was intellectually disabled, and the governor had not spared him either. Herbert would likely be seen as even less sympathetic. I spoke with Herbert regularly during the day by phone to let him know there was no news. I couldn't rely on the prison to get a message to him if the court ruled, so I asked him to call me every 2 hours. Whatever the news, I wanted him to hear it from someone who cared about him. Herbert had met a woman from Mobile with whom he had corresponded over the years. They had decided to get married a week before the execution. Herbert had no money, nothing to offer her if he was executed. But he was a military veteran, so his survivors were entitled to receive an American flag upon his death. He designated his new wife as the person to whom the flag should be presented. In the days leading up to the execution, it seemed that Herbert was more concerned about his flag than his impending execution. He kept asking me to check with the government about how his flag would be delivered, and urging me to get a commitment in writing. His new wife's family had agreed to spend the last few hours with Herbert before the execution. The prison allowed family members to stay until about 10 p.m., when they would begin to prepare the condemned for execution. I was still in my office waiting to receive word from the Supreme Court. When the clock passed 5 p.m. without any news, I allowed myself to become cautiously hopeful. If the court wasn't troubled by anything we'd presented, I expected an earlier ruling on our motion for a stay. So the later it got, the more encouraged I became. At 6 p.m., I was pacing in my small office, nervously running through the possibilities of what the court might be debating so close to the execution hour. Eva and our new investigator, Brenda Lewis, waited with me. Finally, a little before 7 p.m., the phone rang. The clerk of the court was on the line. "Mr. Stevenson, I'm calling to let you know that the court has just entered an order in case number 89-5395. The motion for a stay of execution and petition for writ of certiorari have been denied. We'll fax copies of the order to your office shortly." And with that, the conversation ended. When I hung up, all I could think was, why would I need a copy of the order? To whom did the clerk think I would show it? In a matter of hours, Herbert would be dead. There would be no more appeals, no more records to keep. I'm not sure why I was struck by these peculiar details. Maybe thinking about the procedural absurdities of the court's order was less overwhelming than thinking about its meaning. I had promised Herbert I would be with him during the execution, and it took me a few minutes to realize I needed to move quickly to get to the prison 2 hours away. I jumped in my car and raced to Atmore. As I drove down the interstate to reach the prison, I noticed the long rays of sunlight retreating even as the heat of the Alabama summer persisted. When I arrived at the prison, it was completely dark. Outside the prison entrance were dozens of men with guns sitting on the backs of trucks that lined the long road to the prison parking area. They were state troopers, local police officers, deputy sheriffs, and what appeared to be part of a National Guard unit. I don't know why the state felt they needed a militia to guard the entrance to the prison on the night of an execution. It was surreal to see all of these armed men gathered near midnight to make sure a life would be taken without incident. It fascinated me that someone thought there might be some violent armed resistance to the scheduled execution of an indigent black man. I entered the prison and saw an older white woman, the correctional officer who managed the visitation yard. I had become a regular at death row, visiting my new clients at least once a month, so she saw me frequently, but had never been particularly friendly. Tonight she approached me with unusual warmth and familiarity when I arrived. I thought she was going to hug me. Men in suits and ties hovered in the lobby, eyeing me suspiciously as I walked into the visitation room at a little past 9. The visitation area at Holman is a large, circular room, surrounded by glass so that officers can look in from any vantage point. There are a dozen small tables with chairs inside for visiting family who come on visitation days, typically scheduled 2 or 3 times a month. During the week of a scheduled execution, only the condemned prisoner facing a scheduled death is permitted to have family visits. When I got inside the visiting room, the family had less than an hour left with Herbert. He was calmer than I'd ever seen him. He smiled at me when I walked in and gave me a hug. "Hey, y'all, this is my lawyer." He said it with a pride that was surprising and moving to me. "Hello, everyone," I said. Herbert still had his arm around my shoulder, and I wanted to say something comforting but couldn't think of anything before Herbert jumped in again. "I told the prison people that I want all my possessions distributed just as I've said, or my lawyer will sue you till you all have to work for him." He chuckled and people laughed. I met Herbert's bride and her family and spent the next 45 minutes with one eye on the clock, knowing that at 10 p.m. the guards would take Herbert to the back and we would never see him alive again. Herbert tried to keep things light. He told his family how he had persuaded me to take his case and bragged that I only represented people who were smart and charming. "He's too young to have represented me at trial, but if he had been there, I wouldn't be on death row now." He said it with a smile, but I was starting to feel shaken. I was really struck at how hard he was working to make everyone around him feel better in the face of his own death. I'd never seen him so energetic and gracious. His family and I smiled and laughed, but all of us felt the strain of the moment. His wife became more and more tearful as the minutes ticked away. Shortly before 10 p.m., the commissioner of the Alabama Department of Corrections, the warden, and several other men wearing suits gestured to the visitation officer. She came into the room meekly and regretfully said, "It's time, folks. We've got to end the visit. Say your goodbyes." I watched the men in the hallway. They had clearly been expecting the officer to do something more decisive and effective. They wanted things to proceed on schedule and were clearly ready to move to the next stage to prepare for the execution. One of the state officials walked over to the guard when she left the room and pointed at his watch. Inside the room, Herbert's wife began to sob. She put her arms around his neck and refused to let him go. After a couple of minutes, her crying turned into groaning, distressed and desperate. The officials in the lobby were growing more impatient and gestured at the visitation officer who came back into the room. "I'm sorry," she said as firmly as she could muster, "but you have to leave now." She looked at me and I looked away. Herbert's wife began sobbing again. Her sister and other family members began to cry too. Herbert's wife grabbed him even more tightly. I hadn't thought about how difficult this moment would be. It was surreal in a way I hadn't anticipated. In an instant, a flood of sadness and tragedy had overtaken everyone, and I began to worry that it would be impossible for this family to leave Herbert. By now, the officers were angry. I looked through the window and saw the warden radio for more officers to come into the area. Someone else gestured for the officer to go back into the room and bring the family members out. I heard them tell her not to come out without the family. The officer looked frantic. Despite her uniform, she'd always seemed a little out of place at the prison, and she looked especially uncomfortable now. She had once volunteered to me that her grandson wanted to be a lawyer and that she was hoping he would. She looked around the room nervously and then came up to me. She had tears in her eyes and looked at me desperately. "Please, please, help me get these people out of here, please." I began to worry that things were going to get ugly, but I couldn't sort out what to do. It seemed impossibly hard for them to expect people to just calmly abandon someone they loved so that he could be executed. I wanted to prevent things from getting out of control, but felt powerless to do anything. By this time, Herbert's wife had started saying loudly, "I'm not going to leave you." Herbert had made a peculiar request the week before the execution. He said that if he was executed as scheduled, he wanted me to get the prison to play a recording of a hymn, "The Old Rugged Cross," as he walked to the electric chair. I had been slightly embarrassed to raise the request when I spoke with prison officials, but to my utter amazement, they had agreed to do it. I remembered as a child that they always sang this hymn at somber moments during church services, on Communion Sundays and Good Friday. It was sad, like few other hymns I'd heard. I don't know why exactly, but I started to hum it as I saw more uniformed officers enter the vestibule outside the visitation room. It seemed like something that might help, but help what? After a few minutes, the family joined me. I went over to Herbert's wife as she held him tightly, sobbing softly. I whispered to her, "We have to let him go." Herbert saw the officers lining up outside, and he pulled away from her slowly and told me to take her out of the room. Herbert's wife clung to me and sobbed hysterically as I led her out of the visitation room, with her family tearfully following. The experience was heartbreaking, and I wanted to cry. But I just kept humming instead. The prison had made arrangements for me to go back to the death chamber in about an hour to be with Herbert before the execution. Although I had worked on several death penalty cases with clients who had execution dates, I'd never before been present at an execution. In the cases where I had actually been counsel for the condemned while I was in Georgia, we'd always won stays of execution. I grew anxious thinking about witnessing the spectacle of a man being electrocuted, burned to death in front of me. I'd been so focused on obtaining the stay and then on what to say to Herbert when I got to the prison that I hadn't actually thought about witnessing the execution. I no longer wanted to be there for that, but I didn't want to abandon Herbert. To leave him in a room alone with people who wanted him dead made me realize that I couldn't back out. All of a sudden, the room felt incredibly hot, like there was no air anywhere. The visitation officer came up to me after I had escorted the family out and whispered in my ear, "Thank you." I was vexed by her thinking of me as an accomplice and didn't know what to say. When there were less than 30 minutes before the execution, they took me back to the cell next to the execution chamber, deep inside the prison where they were holding Herbert until it was time to put him in the electric chair. They had shaved the hair off his body to facilitate a clean execution. The state had done nothing to modify the electric chair since the disastrous Evans execution. I thought about the botched execution of Horace Duncan's a month earlier and became even more distraught. I had tried to read up on what should happen at an execution. I had some misguided thought that I could intervene if they did something incorrectly. Herbert was much more emotional when he saw me than he'd been in the visitation room. He looked shaken, and it was clear that he was upset. It must have been humiliating to be shaved in preparation for an execution. He looked worried, and when I walked into the chamber, he grabbed my hands and asked if we could pray. And we did. When we were done, his face took on a distant look, and then he turned to me. "Hey, man, thank you. I know this ain't easy for you either, but I'm grateful to you for standing with me." I smiled and gave him a hug. His face sagged with an unbearable sadness. "It's been a very strange day, Brian, really strange. Most people who feel fine don't get to think all day about this being their last day alive with certainty that they will be killed. It's different than being in Vietnam, much stranger." He nodded at all the officers who were milling about nervously. "It's been strange for them, too. All day long, people have been asking me, 'What can I do to help you?' When I woke up this morning, they kept coming to me, 'Can we get you some breakfast?' At midday, they came to me, 'Can we get you some lunch?' All day long. 'What can we do to help you? This evening, what do you want for your meal? How can we help you? Do you need stamps for your letters? Do you want water? Do you want coffee? Can we get you the phone? How can we help you?'" Herbert sighed and looked away. "It's been so strange, Brian. More people have asked me what they can do to help me in the last 14 hours of my life than ever asked me in the years when I was coming up." He looked at me and his face twisted in confusion. I gave Herbert one last long hug, but I was thinking about what he'd said. I thought of all the evidence that the court had never reviewed about his childhood. I was thinking about all of the trauma and difficulty that had followed him home from Vietnam. I couldn't help but ask myself, Where were these people when he really needed them? Where were all of these helpful people when Herbert was 3 and his mother died? Where were they when he was 7 and trying to recover from physical abuse? Where were they when he was a young teen struggling with drugs and alcohol? Where were they when he returned from Vietnam, traumatized and disabled? I saw the cassette tape recorder that had been set up in the hallway and watched an officer bring over a tape. The sad strains of The Old Rugged Cross began to play as they pulled Herbert away from me. There was a shamefulness about the experience of Herbert's execution I couldn't shake. Everyone I saw at the prison seemed surrounded by a cloud of regret and remorse. The prison officials had pumped themselves up to carry out the execution with determination and resolve, but even they revealed extreme discomfort and some measure of shame. Maybe I was imagining it, but it seemed that everyone recognized that what was taking place was wrong. Abstractions about capital punishment were one thing, but the details of systematically killing someone who is not a threat are completely different. I couldn't stop thinking about it on the trip home. I thought about Herbert, about how desperately he wanted the American flag he earned through his military service in Vietnam. I thought about his family and about the victim's family and the tragedy the crime created for them. I thought about the visitation officer, the Department of Corrections officials, the men who were paid to shave Herbert's body so that he could be killed more efficiently. I thought about the officers who had strapped him into the chair. I kept thinking that no one could actually believe that this was a good thing to do, or even a necessary thing to do. The next day, there were articles in the press about the execution. Some state officials expressed happiness and excitement that an execution had taken place, but I knew that none of them had actually dealt with the details of killing Herbert. In debates about the death penalty, I had started arguing that we would never think it was humane to pay someone to rape people convicted of rape, or assault and abuse someone guilty of assault or abuse. Yet we were comfortable killing people who kill, in part because we think we can do it in a manner that doesn't implicate our own humanity, the way that raping or abusing someone would. I couldn't stop thinking that we don't spend much time contemplating the details of what killing someone actually involves. I went back to my office the next day with renewed energy. I picked up my other case files and made updated plans for how to assist each client to maximize the chance of avoiding an execution. Eventually, I recognized that all of my fresh resolve didn't change much. I was really only trying to reconcile myself to the realities of Herbert's death. I was comforted by the exercise just the same. I felt more determined to recruit staff and obtain resources to meet the growing challenges of providing legal assistance to condemned people. Eva and I talked about a few people who had expressed interest in joining our staff. There was some new financial support possible from a foundation, and that afternoon we finally received the office equipment we had ordered. By the end of the day, I was persuaded things would improve, even while I felt newly burdened by the weight of it all. Chapter 5 Of the Coming of John. It would have been so much easier if he had been out in the woods hunting by himself when that girl was killed. Armilla Hand, Walter McMillan's older sister, paused while the crowd in the small trailer called out in affirmation. I sat on a couch and looked out at the nearly 24 family members, who were staring at me as Armilla spoke. At least then we could understand how it might be possible for him to have done this. She paused and looked down at the floor of the room where we had gathered. But because we were standing next to him that whole morning, we know where he was. We know what he was doing. People hummed in agreement as her voice grew louder and more distraught. It was the kind of wordless testimony of struggle and anguish I heard all the time growing up in a small rural black church. Just about everybody in here was standing next to him, talking to him, laughing with him, eating with him. Then the police come along months later, say he killed somebody miles away at the same time we're standing next to him. Then they take him away when you know it's a lie. She was now struggling to speak. Her hands were trembling, and the emotion in her voice was making it hard to get her words out. We were with him all day. What are we supposed to do, Mr. Stevenson? Tell us, what are we supposed to do with that? Her face twisted in pain. I feel like I've been convicted, too. The small crowd responded to each statement with shouts of yes, and that's right. I feel like they done put me on death row too. What do we tell these children about how to stay out of harm's way when you can be at your own house, minding your own business, surrounded by your entire family, and they still put some murder on you that you ain't due and send you to death row? I sat on the crowded sofa in my suit, staring into the face of a lot of pain. I hadn't expected to have such an intense meeting when I arrived. Folks were desperate for answers and trying to reconcile themselves to a situation that made no sense. I was struggling to think of something appropriate to say when a younger woman spoke up. Johnny D. could have never done this no kind of way, whether we was with him or not, she said, using the nickname Walter's family and friends had given him. He's just not like that. The younger woman was Walter's niece. She continued with her rebuttal to the very idea that Walter would need an alibi, which seemed to generate support among the crowd. I was relieved to have the pressure off me for a moment as Walter's large family seemed to be moving towards some sort of debate over whether Walter's character rendered an alibi unnecessary or even insulting. It had been a long day. I was no longer sure what time it was, but I knew it was very late, and I was wearing down. I'd spent several intense hours on death row earlier in the day with Walter, going over his trial transcript. Before my meeting with Walter, I'd spent time with other new clients on the row. Their cases weren't active and there were no deadlines on the horizon, but I hadn't seen them since the Richardson execution, and they had been anxious to talk. Now that Walter's case record was complete, appeal pleadings would be due soon, and time was critical. I should have returned to Montgomery directly from the prison, but Walter's family wanted to meet, and since they were less than an hour from the prison, I had promised to come to Monroeville. Walter's wife, Minnie Bell McMillan, and his daughter Jackie were waiting patiently when I pulled up to the McMillans' dilapidated house in Repton, which was off the main road leading to Monroeville. Walter had told me I would know I was close when I passed a cluster of liquor stores on the county line between Conecuh and Monroe counties. Monroe County is a dry county where no alcoholic beverages can be sold. For the convenience of its thirsty citizens, several package stores mark the boundary with Conecuh County. Walter's house was just a few miles from the county line. I pulled into the driveway and was surprised at the profound disrepair. This was a poor family's home. The front porch was propped on three cinder blocks, piled precariously beneath wood flooring that showed signs of rot. The blue window panes were in desperate need of paint, and a makeshift set of stairs that didn't connect to the structure was the only access to the home. The yard was littered with abandoned car parts, tires, broken pieces of furniture, and other detritus. Before getting out of my car, I decided to put on my well-worn suit jacket, even though I had noticed earlier that it was missing buttons on both jacket sleeves. Minnie walked out the front door and apologized for the appearance of the yard as I carefully stepped onto the porch. She kindly invited me inside while a woman in her early 20s lingered behind her. "Let me fix something for you to eat. You've been at the prison all day," she said. Minnie looked tired, but otherwise appeared as I had imagined, patient and strong, based on Walter's descriptions and my own guesses from our phone conversations. Because the state had made Walter's affair with Karen Kelly part of its case in court, the trial had been especially difficult for Minnie. But she looked like she was still standing strong. "Oh no, thank you, I appreciate it, but it's fine. Walter and I ate some things on the visitation yard. They don't have nothing on that prison yard but chips and sodas. Let me cook you something good." "That's very kind, I appreciate it, but I'm really okay. I know you've been working all day, too." "Well, yes. I'm on 12-hour shifts at the plant. Then people don't want to hear nothing about your business, your sickness, your nerves, your out-of-town guests, and definitely nothing about your family problems." She didn't sound angry or bitter, just sad. She walked over to me, gently looped her arm with mine, and slowly led me into the house. We sat down on a sofa in the crowded living room. Chairs that didn't match were piled with papers and clothes. Her grandchildren's toys were scattered on the floor. Minnie sat close to me, almost leaning on me as she continued speaking softly. "Work people tell you to be there, so you gotta go. I'm trying to get her through school, and it ain't easy." She nodded to her daughter Jackie, who looked back at her mother sympathetically. Jackie walked across the room and sat near us. Walter and Minnie had mentioned their children, Jackie, Johnny, and Boot to me several times. Jackie's name was always followed by "she's in college." I had begun to think of her as Jackie, She's in College McMillan. All of the kids were in their 20s, but still very close and protective of their mother. I told them about my visit with Walter. Minnie hadn't been to the prison in several months and seemed grateful that I had spent some time there. I went over the appeals process with them and talked about the next steps in the case. They confirmed Walter's alibi and updated me on all the rumors in town currently circulating about the case. I believe it was that old man Miles Jackson who done it, Minnie said emphatically. I think it's the new owner Rick Blair, Jackie said. Everybody knows they found a white man's skin under that girl's fingernails where she had fought whoever killed her. Well, we're going to get to the truth, I said. I tried to sound confident, but given what I'd read in the trial transcript, I thought it very unlikely that the police would turn over the evidence to me or let me see the files and the materials collected from the crime scene. Even in the transcript, the law enforcement officers who had investigated Walter seemed lawless. These police put Walter on death row while he was a pretrial detainee. I feared that they would not scrupulously follow the legal requirement to turn over all exculpatory evidence that could help him prove his innocence. We talked for well over an hour, or they talked while I listened. You could tell how traumatizing the last 18 months since Walter's arrest had been. The trial was the worst, Minnie said. They just ignored what we told them about Johnny D being home. Nobody has explained to me why they did that. Why did they do that? She looked at me as if she honestly hoped I could provide an answer. This trial was constructed with lies, I said. I was wary about expressing such strong opinions to Walter's family because I hadn't investigated the case enough to be sure there was more evidence to convict Walter. But reading the record of his trial had outraged me, and I felt that anger returning, not just about the injustice done to Walter, but also about the way it had burdened the entire community. Everyone in the poor black community who had talked to me about the case had expressed hopelessness. This one massive miscarriage of justice had afflicted the whole community with despair and made it hard for me to be dispassionate. One lie after the other, I continued. People were fed so many lies that by the time y'all started telling the truth, it was just easier to believe you were the ones who were lying. It frustrates me to even read it in the trial record, so I can only imagine how you all feel. The phone rang and Jackie jumped up to answer it. She came back a few minutes later. Eddie said that people are getting restless. They want to know when he's going to be there. Minnie stood up and straightened her dress. Well, we should probably get going down there. They've been waiting most of the day for you. When I looked confused, Minnie smiled. Oh, I told the rest of the family we would bring you down there, since it's so hard to find where they live if you've never been there before. His sisters, nephews, nieces, and other folks all want to meet you. I tried not to show my alarm, but I was getting worried about the time. We piled into my two-door Corolla, which was stacked with papers, trial transcripts, and court records. You must spend your money on other things, Jackie joked as we pulled away. Yes, expensive suits are my spending priority these days, I replied. There's nothing wrong with your suit or your car, Minnie said protectively. I followed their directions down a long, winding dirt road full of impossible turns through a heavily wooded area. As darkness fell around us, the road twisted through dense forest for several miles until it came to a short, narrow bridge with room for only one car to pass. It looked shaky and unstable, so I slowed the car to a stop. It's okay. It hasn't rained that much, and that's the only time when it's really a problem, Minnie said. What kind of problem? I didn't want to sound scared, but we were in the middle of nowhere, and in the pitch black night I couldn't tell whether it was a swamp, a creek, or a small river under the bridge. It will be all right. People drive through here every day, Jackie chimed in. It would have been too embarrassing to turn around, so I drove slowly across the bridge and was relieved when we had made it to the other side. I continued for another mile until the forest began to give way to trailers, a few small homes, and finally an entire community hidden away in the woods. We pulled up a hill until we reached a trailer that was glowing in the darkness, lit by a fire burning in a barrel out front. Six or seven small children were playing outside. They dashed into the trailer when they saw our car pull up. As we got out of the car, a tall man emerged from the trailer. He walked up to us and hugged Minnie and Jackie before shaking my hand. They've been waiting for you, he told me. I know you probably got a lot of work to do, but we appreciate you coming to meet with us. I'm Giles, Walter's nephew." Giles led me to the trailer and opened the door for me to step inside. The small home was packed with more than 30 people, whose chattering fell silent when I walked in. I was startled by the size of the group, which stared at me appraisingly, and then one by one started to smile at me. Then, to my amazement, the room broke into loud applause. I was stunned by the gesture. No one had ever applauded me just for showing up. There were older women, younger women, men Walter's age, and several men much older. Their faces were creased with a by now familiar look of anxiety. When the applause had died down, I began to speak. "Thank you, that's very kind," I started. "I'm so glad to meet you all. Mr. McMillan told me he had a large family, but I didn't expect so many of you to be here. I saw him today, and he wants me to pass along his thanks and his gratitude to all of you for sticking by him. I hope you know how much your support means. He has to wake up on death row every morning, and that's not easy. But he knows he's not alone, and he talks about you all the time." "Sit down, Mr. Stevenson," someone shouted. I took a seat on an empty couch that seemed to have been reserved for me, and Minnie sat down beside me. Everyone else stood facing me. "We don't have any money. We gave it all to the first lawyer," called out one of the men. "I understand that, and I won't take a penny. I work for a nonprofit law office, and we provide legal assistance at no cost to the people we represent," I replied. "Well, how do you pay the bills?" asked one young woman. People laughed at the question. "We get donations from foundations and people who support our work." "Well, you get Johnny D home, and I'll make all kinds of donations," said another woman slyly. People laughed, and I smiled. An older woman spoke up. It was Armilla Hand. "We don't have much, Mr. Stevenson, but you have someone we love in your care. Anything we have, you have. These people have broken our hearts," she said. I began answering questions and listening to comments and testimonials about Walter, the town, race, the police, the trial, and the way the whole family was now being treated by people in the community. The hours passed, and I knew that I had probably exhausted whatever helpful information could be obtained from Walter's family, but folks still wanted to talk. There seemed to be therapeutic relief in voicing their concerns to me. Before long, I heard some hopefulness in their questions and comments. I explained the appeals process and talked about the kind of issues that were already apparent from the record. I began to feel encouraged that some of the information I provided maybe eased their anxiety. We started to joke some, and before I knew it, I felt embraced in a way that energized me. An older woman had given me a tall glass of sweet iced tea as I sat there listening and responding to questions. I drank the first glass thirstily because I was a little nervous. The tea was very good. The woman watched me drain the glass and smiled at me with a look of great satisfaction. She quickly filled the glass, and no matter how much or how little I drank, she minded my glass religiously the entire evening. After over 3 hours, Minnie grabbed my hand and announced that they should let me go. It was close to midnight, and it would take me at least 2 hours to get to Montgomery. I said my farewells and exchanged hugs with practically everyone in the room before stepping out into the dark night. December is rarely bitter cold in South Alabama during the day, but at night the temperatures can drop, a dramatic reminder that it's winter, even in the South. Without an overcoat, I cranked up the heat for the long drive home after dropping Minnie and Jackie back at their house. The meeting with the family had been inspiring. There were clearly a lot of people who cared deeply about Walter and consequently cared about what I did and how I could help. But it was also clear that people had been traumatized by what had happened. Several of the people I met weren't actually related but had been at the fish fry on the day of the crime. They were so deeply disturbed by Walter's conviction that they, too, had come over when they heard that I was coming. They needed a place to share their hurt and confusion. In 1903, W.E.B. Du Bois included in his seminal work, The Souls of Black Folk, a brilliant but haunting short story. I thought about Of the Coming of John on the drive home. In Du Bois's story, a young black man in coastal Georgia is sent off hundreds of miles to a school that trains black teachers. The entire black community where he was born had raised the money for his tuition. The community invests in John so that he can one day return and teach African-American children who are barred from attending the public school. Casual and fun-loving, John almost flunks out of his new school until he considers the trust he's been given and the shame he would face if he returned without graduating. Newly focused, sober, and intensely committed to succeed, he graduates with honors and returns to his community intent on changing things. John convinces the white judge who controls the town to allow him to open a school for black children. His education has empowered him, and he has strong opinions about racial freedom and equality that land him and the black community in trouble. The judge shuts down the school when he hears what John's been teaching. John walks home after the school's closing, frustrated and distraught. On the trip home, he sees his sister being groped by the judge's adult son, and he reacts violently, striking the man in the head with a piece of wood. John continues home to say goodbye to his mother. Du Bois ends the tragic story when the furious judge catches up to John with the lynch mob he has assembled. I read the story several times in college because I identified with John as the hope of an entire community. None of my aunts or uncles had graduated from college. Many hadn't graduated from high school. The people in my church always encouraged me and never asked me for anything back, but I felt a debt accumulating. Du Bois understood this dynamic deeply and brought it to life in a way that absolutely fascinated me. I just hoped that my parallel with John wouldn't extend to the getting lynched part. Driving home that night from meeting Walter's family, I thought of the story in a whole new way. I had never before considered how devastated John's community must have felt after his lynching. Things would become so much harder for the people who had given everything to help make John a teacher. For the surviving black community, there would be more obstacles to opportunity and progress, and much heartache. John's education had led not to liberation and progress, but to violence and tragedy. There would be more distrust, more animosity, and more injustice. Walter's family and most poor black people in his community were similarly burdened by Walter's conviction. Even if they hadn't been at his house the day of the crime, most black people in Monroeville knew someone who had been with Walter that day. The pain in that trailer was tangible. I could feel it. The community seemed desperate for some hope of justice. The realization left me anxious but determined. I'd gotten used to taking calls from lots of people concerning Walter's case. Most were poor and black, and they offered encouragement and support, and my visit with the family generated even more of those calls. And occasionally, a white person for whom Walter had worked would call to offer support, like Sam Crook. When Sam called, he insisted that I come and see him the next time I was back in town. "I'm a rebel," he said toward the end of our call, "part of the 117th Division of the Confederate Army." "Sir?" "My people were heroes of the Confederacy. I've inherited their land, their title, and their pride. I love this county, but I know what happened to Walter McMillan ain't right." "Well, I appreciate your call." "You're going to need some backup, someone who knows some of these people you're going against, and I'm going to help you." "I'd be very grateful for your help." "I'll tell you something else." He lowered his voice. "Do you think your phone is being tapped?" "No, sir, I think my phone is clear." Sam's voice rose in volume again. "Well, I've decided I ain't going to let them string him up. I'll get some boys, and we'll go cut him down before we let them take him. I'm just not going to stand for them putting a good man down for something I know he didn't do." Sam Crook spoke in grand proclamations. I hesitated over how to respond. "Well, thank you," was all I could manage. When I later asked Walter about Sam Crook, he just smiled. "I've done a lot of work for him. He's been good to me. He's a very interesting guy." I saw Walter just about every other week for those first few months, and I learned some of his habits. Interesting was Walter's euphemism for odd people, and having worked for hundreds of people throughout the county over the years, he'd encountered no shortage of interesting people. The more unusual or bizarre the person was, the more interesting they would become in Walter's parlance. "Very interesting, and real interesting, and finally, now he's real interesting," were the markers for strange and stranger characters. Walter seemed reluctant to say anything bad about anyone. He'd just chuckle if he thought someone was odd. Walter grew much more relaxed during our visits. As we became more comfortable with each other, he would sometimes veer into topics that had nothing to do with the case. We talked about the guards at the prison and his experiences dealing with other prisoners. He talked about people back home he thought would visit but hadn't. In these conversations, Walter showed remarkable empathy. He spent a lot of time imagining what other people were thinking and feeling that might mitigate their behavior. He guessed what frustrations guards must be experiencing to excuse the rude things they said to him. He gave voice to how hard it must be to visit someone on death row. We talked about the food he liked, jobs he'd worked when he was younger. We talked about race and power, the things we saw that were funny and the things we saw that were sad. It made him feel better to have a normal conversation with someone who wasn't on the row or a guard, and I always spent extra time with him to talk about things unrelated to the case. Not just for him, but for myself as well. I was trying so hard to get the project off the ground that my work had quickly become my life. I found something refreshing in the moments I spent with clients when we didn't relate to one another as attorney and client, but as friends. Walter's case was becoming the most complicated and time-consuming I'd ever worked on, and spending time with him was comforting even though it made me feel the pressure of his mistreatment in ways that became increasingly personal. "Man, all these guys talk about how you're working on their case. You must not ever get any peace," he told me once. "Well, everybody needs help, so we're trying." He gave me an odd look that I hadn't seen before. I think he wasn't sure whether he could give me advice. He hadn't done that yet. Finally, he seemed to say what he was thinking. "Well, you know you can't help everybody." He looked at me earnestly. "You'll kill yourself if you try to do that." He continued looking at me with concern. I smiled. "I know. I mean, you gotta help me. You shouldn't hold nothing back on my case," he said with a smile. "I expect you to fight all comers to get me out of here. Take them all down if necessary. Stand up to giants? Slay wild beasts? Wrestle alligators?" I joked. "Yeah, and get somebody ready to take over the battle in case they chop your head off, because I'm still going to need help if they take you out." The more time I spent with Walter, the more I was persuaded that he was a kind, decent man with a generous nature. He freely acknowledged that he'd made poor decisions, particularly where women were concerned. By all accounts, from friends, family, and associates like Sam Crook, Walter generally tried to do the right thing. I never regarded our time together as wasted or unproductive. In all death penalty cases, spending time with clients is important. Developing the trust of clients is not only necessary to manage the complexities of the litigation and deal with the stress of a potential execution, it's also key to effective advocacy. A client's life often depends on his lawyer's ability to create a mitigation narrative that contextualizes his poor decisions or violent behavior. Uncovering things about someone's background that no one has previously discovered, things that might be hard to discuss but are critically important, requires trust. Getting someone to acknowledge he has been the victim of child sexual abuse, neglect, or abandonment won't happen without the kind of comfort that takes hours and multiple visits to develop. Talking about sports, TV, popular culture, or anything else the client wants to discuss is absolutely appropriate to building a relationship that makes effective work possible. But it also creates genuine connections with clients. And that's certainly what happened with Walter. Shortly after my first trip to see Walter's family, I received a call from a young man named Darnell Houston, who told me that he could prove that Walter was innocent. His voice shook with nerves, but he was determined to speak to me. He didn't want to talk on the phone, so I drove down to meet with him one afternoon. He lived in a rural part of Monroe County on farmland that his family had worked since the time of slavery. Darnell was a sincere young man, and I could tell he'd been debating for a while whether to contact me. When I arrived at his home, he walked out to greet me. He was a young black man in his 20s who had joined the Jerry Curl craze. I had already noticed that the popular process of chemically treating black hair to make it looser and easier to style had come to Monroeville. I'd seen several black men, young and old, sporting the look with pride. The cheerful bounce of Darnell's hair contrasted with his worried demeanor. As soon as we sat down, he got right to business. Mr. Stevenson, I can prove that Walter McMillan is innocent.
Really?
Bill Hooks is lying. I didn't know he was even involved in that case until they told me he was part of how they put Walter McMillan on death row. First, I didn't believe Bill could have been part of this, but then I found out that he testified that he drove by the cleaners on the day that girl was killed, and that's a lie.
How do you know?
We were working together all that day. We both worked at the Napa Auto Parts store last November. I remember that Saturday when that girl was killed because ambulances and police started racing up the street. It went on for like 30 minutes. I'd been working in town for a couple of years and had never seen anything like it.
You were working on the Saturday morning that Rhonda Morrison was killed?
Yes, sir, with Bill Hooks from about 8 in the morning till we closed after lunch, after all them ambulances went by our shop. It was probably close to 11 when the siren started. Bill was working on a car in the shop with me. There ain't but one way out the store. He never left the entire morning. If he said he drove by the cleaners when that girl was killed, he's lying. One of the most frustrating things about reading Walter's trial record had been that the state's witnesses, Ralph Myers, Bill Hooks, and Joe Hightower, were so obviously not believable. Their testimony was laughably inconsistent and completely lacking in credibility. Myers' account of his role in the crime, Walter kidnapping him to drive him to the crime scene and then dropping him off afterward, never made any sense. Hooks, a critical witness against McMillan, wasn't persuasive or reliable in the transcript. He just repeated the same story he'd given the police about driving by the cleaners at the time of the crime. His response to every line of questioning was to repeat over and over again that he saw Walter McMillan walk out of the store with a bag, get into his lowrider truck, and get driven away by a white man. He could not answer any of Chestnut's questions about what else he saw that day or what he was doing in the area. He just kept repeating that he saw McMillan at the cleaners. But the state needed Hook's testimony. My plan had been to immediately appeal Walter's conviction to the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals. The state had done so little to prove Walter's guilt that there weren't a lot of legal issues to appeal. But the evidence against him was so unpersuasive that I was hopeful the court might overturn the conviction simply because it was so unreliable. Once the case was on direct appeal, no new evidence would be considered. The time for filing a motion for a new trial in the trial court, the last chance to introduce new facts before an appeal begins, had already expired. Chestnut and Boynton, Walter's lawyers for the initial trial, had filed a motion before withdrawing, and Judge Key had quickly denied it. Darnell said he told Walter's former lawyers what he told me, and that they had raised it in a motion for a new trial, but no one took it seriously. In capital cases, a motion for a new trial is routinely filed but rarely granted. But if the defendant alleges new evidence that could lead to a different outcome in the case, or that undermines the reliability of the trial, there is typically a hearing. After speaking with Darnell, I thought about refiling his assertions before the case went up on appeal, and maybe, just maybe, we could persuade local officials to retreat from the case against Walter. I made a motion to reconsider the denial of a new trial for Mr. McMillan. I immediately got an affidavit from Darnell stating that Hook's testimony was a lie. I took the risk of talking to a few local lawyers about whether the new prosecutor might acknowledge that the conviction was unreliable and support a new trial if there was compelling new evidence. Several people had suggested that Tom Chapman, the new Monroe County District Attorney and a former criminal defense attorney, would be fairer and more sympathetic to someone wrongly convicted than lifelong prosecutor Ted Pearson. After Pearson's long tenure as DA, Chapman's election represented something of a new era. He was in his 40s and had talked about modernizing law enforcement in the region. Some said that he was ambitious and might want to run for statewide office someday. I also discovered that he had represented Karen Kelly in a prior proceeding, which told me that he was already familiar with the case. I was hopeful. I was still sorting out how to proceed when Darnell called me at my office.
Mr. Stevenson, you have to help. They arrested me this morning and took me to the jail. I just got out on bond.
What?
I asked them what I had done, and they told me I was being charged with perjury.
He sounded terrified.
perjury, based on what you told Mr. McMillan's lawyers a year ago? Have they come to interview you or talk to you since we got your statement? You were supposed to let me know if you heard from them.
No, sir, I haven't heard from any of them. They just came and arrested me and told me I had been indicted for perjury.
I hung up with Darnell, shocked and furious. It was unheard of to indict someone for perjury without any investigation or compelling evidence to establish that a false statement had been made. Police and prosecutors had found out that Darnell was talking to us, and they decided to punish him for it. A few days later, I called the new DA to set up a meeting. On my way to his office, I decided to give him a chance to explain what was going on, instead of angrily complaining about the insanity of indicting someone for perjury because he had contradicted a state's witness. I decided to wait until after my meeting before filing my stack of motions. This was my first meeting with anyone associated with Walter's prosecution, and I didn't want to begin with an angry accusation. I had allowed myself to believe that the people who had prosecuted Walter were just misguided, possibly incompetent. I knew some of them were bigoted and abusive, but I guess I held out the hope that they could be reoriented. Indicting Darnell was a worrisome signal that they were willing to threaten and intimidate people. The Monroe County Courthouse is situated in the heart of downtown Monroeville. I drove into town, parked, and entered the courthouse looking for the district attorney's office. On my only other trip to the courthouse a month earlier, I had gone to the clerk's office to pick up files, and the staff had asked me where I was from. When I said Montgomery, they launched into a lecture about Monroeville's prominence as a result of Harper Lee and her famous novel. I remember how the clerk had chatted me up. "Have you read the book? It's a wonderful story. This is a famous place. They made the old courthouse a museum. And when they made the movie, Gregory Peck came here. You should go over there and stand where Mr. Peck stood. I mean, where Atticus Finch stood." She giggled with excitement, although I imagine she said the same thing to every out-of-town attorney who wandered in. She continued talking enthusiastically about the story until I promised to visit the museum as soon as I could. I refrained from explaining that I was too busy working on the case of an innocent black man the community was trying to execute after a racially biased prosecution. During this trip, I was in a different frame of mind. The last thing I was interested in was a fictional story about justice. I walked through the courthouse until I found the district attorney's office. I announced myself to the secretary, who eyed me suspiciously before directing me into Chapman's office. He walked over to shake my hand. Chapman started off by saying, "Mr. Stevenson, lots of people want to meet you. I told them you were coming down, but decided that just you and I should talk." It didn't surprise me that word had gotten around, and that people were talking about Walter's new attorney. I had talked to enough people in the community to know that people would be discussing my efforts on Walter's behalf. My guess is that Judge Key had already characterized me as misguided and uncooperative simply because I didn't get off the case, as he had directed. Chapman had a medium build, curly hair, and glasses that suggested he didn't mind looking like someone who spent time reading and studying. I'd met prosecutors who dressed and presented like they would rather be out hunting ducks than running a law office, but Chapman was professional and courteous and approached me with a pleasant demeanor. I was intrigued that he would immediately give voice to the concerns of other people in law enforcement, and was initially encouraged that he meant for us to have a candid conversation, free of distractions and posturing. "Well, I appreciate that," I said. "I'm very concerned about this McMillan case. I've read the record, and to be honest, I have serious doubts about his guilt and the reliability of this conviction."
"Well, this was a big case, there's no doubt about it. You do understand that I didn't have anything to do with the prosecution, don't you?"
"Yes, I do."
"This was one of the most outrageous crimes in Monroe County history, and your client made a lot of people here extremely angry. People are still angry, Mr. Stevenson. There's not enough bad that can happen to Walter McMillan for some of them."
This was a disappointing beginning. He seemed completely convinced of Walter's guilt, but I pressed on.
"Well, it was an outrageous, tragic crime, so anger is understandable," I replied. "But it doesn't accomplish anything to convict the wrong person. Whether Mr. McMillan has done anything wrong is what the trial should resolve.
If the trial is unfair, or if witnesses have given false testimony, then we can't really know whether he's guilty or not.
Well, you may be the only person right now who thinks the trial was unfair. Like I said, I wasn't involved in the prosecution.
I was becoming frustrated, and Chapman probably saw me shift in my seat. I thought about the dozens of black people I'd met who had complained bitterly about Walter's prosecution, and I was starting to see Chapman as either naive or willfully indifferent, or worse. I tried unsuccessfully not to let my disappointment show.
I'm not the only person with questions about this case, Mr. Chapman. There's a whole community of people, some of whom claim to have been with Walter McMillan miles away when the crime was committed, who believe in his innocence. There are people for whom he's worked who are absolutely convinced that he did not commit this crime.
I've talked to some of those people, Chapman responded, and they can only have uninformed opinions. They don't have facts. Look, I can tell you right now that nobody cares who slept with Karen Kelly. There's evidence that implicates Walter McMillan for this murder, and my job is to defend this conviction.
He was becoming more argumentative, and his voice was rising. The calm and curious look he had initially given me was shifting into anger and disgust.
Well, you've indicted someone for perjury for contradicting the state's case. Do you intend to prosecute everyone who challenges the evidence in this case?